This is Fresh Air. Neil Jordan has temporarily given up on Hollywood, and I'm glad he has. It leaves him free to make idiosyncratic films. Jordan is an Irish writer and director best known for the movie Mona Lisa. After the success of that film, he came to the States to direct the comedy High Spirits. His spirits sunk when he lost control of the final cut. His next film, a remake of We're No Angels, starring Robert De Niro and Sean Penn, was a box office disappointment. Jordan headed back to Ireland and made the independent film The Miracle. His new movie, The Crying Game, was described by New Yorker film critic Terence Rafferty as amazing, a daring poetic imagining of what it means never to feel the same about anything again. I had the pleasure of seeing this film before I knew anything about it, and if you decide to see it, I'd like you to experience the same surprise as I did. So I'm not going to give away any of the plot twists and character revelations. I asked Neil Jordan if it's hard for him to discuss the movie without revealing too much.
No, it's not really, because I can talk about the themes in the film without talking about the plot, you know. But there are several, there are three or four plot points which the thing turns on, and they change your perception of what you've watched before. And I think half of the pleasure of the movie is audience actually discovering these for themselves.
Let's talk a little bit about the beginning of the movie. I think we can discuss this. In the first part of the film, a woman is seduced by a black British soldier, played by Forrest Whitaker. And then she takes him hostage. It turns out she's a member of the IRA. And they're giving the British Army 3 days to release IRA prisoners in return for the release of this soldier.
Yeah. Did this ever happen?
the main character, played by Stephen Ray, ends up talking to the prisoner and building some kind of relationship with him.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what, if any, relationship you've had either with the IRA or with friends or acquaintances who've been members of the IRA.
Well, I think every Irish person has, you know, they've got it in their family. You know, my grandfather was involved in some ways in the earlier IRA, in the old IRA, in the 1960 and 1921 period, you know. And it's quite close to living memory, that is, you know. And I think this conflict has been going on for about 20 years in the north of Ireland, so I think Irish people do know it. They know it instinctively in themselves, and quite a few Irish people know people who've gotten involved, gotten into trouble.
In the beginning of the film, you know, you really think about the kind of temperament that it takes to be able to think of a person as a symbol of what they represent, you know, to think of a person as a symbol of the British Army. Did you get into a lot of political, ethical arguments with friends about the IRA and what its tactics were and what was too much?
No, I didn't. I mean, I just take it as read. You know, I take it as read that they are people who do things. They use violence for political ends, you know what I mean? And they're often portrayed as psychopaths, but the problem with the IRA is not that they're psychopaths. The problem is that they're not, that they're actually, they've got a very cogent program, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I really just wanted to make the film as honestly, I just wanted to observe these characters as honestly as I could and ask no questions and make no judgments, you know? I didn't want to villainize anybody, either a British Army person or an IRA person or anybody, you know? So the challenge for me really was just in actually seeing them as human beings, and that itself has turned out to be kind of a political hot potato, you know, because you're not meant to be allowed to do that.
How has it become a political hot potato?
Well, in Britain, you know, in Ireland, any examination of these issues at all causes some controversy, you know. But and particularly showing a central character like Fergus, character played by Stephen Ray, showing a character like him who has qualms about what he's doing, you know, who has a conscience and who has got feelings, you know. People would prefer to demonize the entire movement, I suppose, you know, because it makes them uncomfortable.
You know, you said you wanted to create characters without passing judgment on them, and I think that's one of the themes that's run through several of your films, you know, not passing judgment on people politically, sexually, you know, whether the characters are involved with crime or a prostitute in some of your earlier work. Is that something that comes natural to you?
What, not to pass
not
judgment?
Passing judgment, you know, just accepting people for what they are.
Well, no, I like to take characters that otherwise would be, I'm like obsessed with redemption, you know, the redemption of characters who would seem to be irredeemable, you know, the humanization of characters who seem to be inhuman, you know, or seem to be beyond some kind of, beyond our normal kind of bourgeois acceptance level, you know, under the I suppose seeing heroism, you know, seeing heroism and dignity in areas that it's not normally seen.
that your interest in redemption, does that come at all from a religious upbringing?
Well, I've got this Catholic baggage somewhere in the back of my brain, you know. I mean, I don't practice it, but it's somewhere there.
Was there a lot of religious imagery or, you know, redemptive symbolism in your upbringing?
Oh, yeah, no, I grew up surrounded by holy pictures. Of course I did. You know, every Irish kid did. I mean, I grew up in a medieval kind of mental world, really. Oh. The Catholic Church, I mean, I think everybody knows what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fascinating kind of wonderfully perverse, you know, system of kind of imagery, really. Blood and suffering. It's the images that stick with me rather than the moral system in a way, you know, but the images are still there.
Now, and another thing that runs through some of your movies, including this new movie, is the impossible, the miraculous. Does that come to you?
Well, I come from a country that's full of fairy tales. You know, I come from a country that's full of a kind of a verbal culture where the kind of peasant folklore or the peasant imagination still is quite close to the, you know, still is a very important part of the culture, you know. I mean, my father, we came from Roscommon, a small farm in Roscommon. He just moved to Dublin, you know, when I was born, you know, so that this kind of peasant thing is still quite strong, and even if you grew up in Dublin. Irish people tend to be very, you know, they tend to be very impatient with reality. You know, they're far happier dealing with their imaginations, you know, and they're not very good with reality in many ways. And I suppose that all that sort of stuff informs my work as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me quote something that Terence Rafferty said about your new movie, and this was in the New Yorker magazine. He compared it to, quote, emerging from the dark woods horror of a grim fairy tale.
Uh-huh.
And,
yes.
I mean, your movie Company of Wolves, one of your early films,
was actually based on
fairy tales.
On a grim fairy tale. Well, it was based on the Little Red Riding Hood, wasn't it?
Yeah. So why do fairy tales have that kind of resonance?
Well, they go deep. You know, fairy tales go very deep. They go... I mean, they're simple stories. What I love about fairy tales is they don't explain themselves, you know. They talk about a little girl walking down a dark wood and, you know, or a princess who sleeping under a mattress with a pea or whatever. You know, they're little parables, and they don't offer any explanation whatsoever, any rational explanation, you know, and they kind of work on a rational and a irrational and subliminal level, you know. They and I think they give us access to areas of our unconscious that we normally don't get to.
In an interview with a Film Comment a few years ago, you said, I connect movies with sex and isolation. I connect them with forbidden things, rich, strange things that don't happen in real life. Is that connected to what you're saying about fairy tales?
Perhaps, yeah. It's I mean, films are larger than life, you know. They do work on us in a way that is bigger than our rational, you know, are the way we rationally explain them away, you know. When I first was struck by movies when I was a kid, I suppose they spoke to me in ways that I didn't fully understand. You know, they spoke to me, parts of me that I didn't fully understand. And I suppose I try to make the films that I make now, I try to make them speak in the same way.
Were you allowed to see any movie you wanted to?
When I was a kid, no. No, I was... I suppose it was a kind of forbidden pleasure because I grew up in a very strict household, you know, and... the movies that I was allowed to go to the films about once every 2 weeks, which is what to most American kids I would say seemed like an extraordinary kind of confinement, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But my parents used to only let me go to see westerns and war movies, you know, and the school every now and then would drag you out to a religious epic.
My guest is Neil Jordan. He wrote and directed the new movie The Crying Game. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and director Neil Jordan. His movies include Mona Lisa, The Company of Wolves, The Miracle, and the new movie, The Crying Game. Another theme in some of your movies is loving somebody who you're really not supposed to love for one reason or another.
Yeah.
And I guess I'd really like to know why that is a theme that is obviously a really important one for you. I mean, it obviously has some kind of real personal resonance for you.
Loving somebody that you're not supposed to love. Well, I probably do it all the time. No, it's more actually being... I suppose, the operations of the heart, you know? Romantic obsession, you know, as a... That's a hugely disruptive force, isn't it, you know? And it's probably a more important force than... people ever admit to themselves, you know? I always think of that that little scene in Citizen Kane, you know, where the old guy is talking to the investigator, and he says, they're talking about Rosebud, and he tells that story about that girl he saw on the boat in Stratton Island Ferry in a white dress when he was 20 years old, and how he never even knew her name or never met her since, but never a day goes past but that he thinks of that woman. Do you remember that little bit?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think romantic obsessions are like that, you know what I mean? They're actually, we think that we're obsessed with the person in question, you know, we think we understand what drives us, but actually they're about something far deeper in ourselves that actually possibly can never be satisfied, you know.
The Stephen Ray character comes to London after a series of events, which I won't give away. But what was it like for you when you first came to London?
It was very like that.
After growing up in Ireland.
It was very like that. I worked in construction. I had the best job in the world, actually. It was knocking down buildings, you know. I'd recommend it to anybody who was pathologically inclined, you know.
Pathologically inclined?
Oh. No, you get a huge amount of anger if you're given a lump hammer and told to go in an 18th century room and tear it to pieces, you know. It's good. But I lived in that world of immigrant Irish labour, you know. Which is, so I put, when I wrote these scenes where Stephen Ray goes to London, I put a lot of my own experience in there, my own memories, you know, little details.
Well, he becomes very anonymous, which is kind of good for him since he's on the lam. But you were not hiding out from the authorities. Did you feel more anonymous, and how did you like it?
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, traditionally Irish people go to London to escape. You know, I mean, I grew up in the 50s, it was a very hidebound little society, you know. And to go to London was a great escape, you know, because you're in a culture that doesn't know you. You know, nobody knows your name, nobody knows who you are. You could be anybody. You know, you could change your name if you wanted. You could change your hair, change everything, change your sex if you wanted. You know, it was that kind of place to me. I mean, to Irish people, it is that kind of place.
What did you go to London to escape from?
I went to London to escape from, I suppose, the confines of a rather rigid, kind of rather rigid Catholic society, really.
So once
I also went to get a job, actually. I couldn't get a job in Ireland.
So when you got to London, were things ever not what they seemed to be? Were there things that fooled you or disappointed you or surprised you?
When I got to London?
I'm thinking of like when your main character gets to London, he's confused by some things and fooled by some things. And I was wondering if you were confused or fooled.
Yeah, of course. I mean, he reads all the signals wrong, doesn't he? I mean, he's in a bar, he doesn't know the nature of the bar, he meets a girl, he doesn't know the nature of the girl, he's a country boy in a big city, you know, which is exactly what I was, you know, I was a country boy in a big city, and, you know, but I suppose naivety carries you through a multitude, really, doesn't it, you know, a certain kind of naivety and innocence enables one to go into any situation, no matter how troublesome or potentially dangerous it may be, and to emerge unscathed, you know. And to a certain extent, Fergus is like that in the film. I know he's a killer and all that sort of stuff, but at heart, he's got a certain innocence, hasn't he?
In several of your films, there's a song that is very associated with the movie, Mona Lisa, Nat Cole's recording of Mona Lisa. In The Miracle, it was the song Stardust. And in your new movie, it's the record The Crying Game. Now, I didn't know this record or the song before seeing the movie.
Yeah, it wasn't a hit in America, sure it wasn't. It was a hit for about 5 minutes in England in 1967.
Oh.
Or maybe it was 1969. I remember it anyway myself very strongly when I was a kid.
What's the association?
The association with the song?
Yeah.
Well, it was a guy called Dave Berry, and he brought a strange theatricality to his performances. I used to see him on television, you know. He used to do these strange kind of theatrical acts. It was a bit as if you'd seen, it was a bit, he kind of predated David Bowie, you know, that kind of rather camp kind of thing that David Bowie does,
mm-hmm.
used to do. And when I was a kid, I found the song fascinating, you know, it had a cheap, schmaltzy kind of poetry about it, you know, and that said something to me. And if I'm writing a script or I'm making a film, I find this, you know, there's many uses for a song, you know, apart from just the normal promotional ones. I mean, the thing about a song is it actually can, you know, build up the whole emotional world, like present the whole emotional world of the character, like the Nat King Cole song in Mona Lisa. It told you exactly where Bob Hoskins was coming from, you know. It told you exactly the kind of 50s romanticism, you know, that, you know, this obsessed kind of romantic guy he is or could become, you know. In terms of The Crying Game, when I wrote the character Dale, I just always thought of it as her song. You know, it somehow expressed
her character.
Neil Jordan wrote and directed the new film, The Crying Game.